Hello, and welcome to Money Talks. I'm Slate Money, where we chat with brilliant and interesting people. I'm Emily Peck. I'm a markets correspondent at Axios and co-host of Slate Money. And I'm here today with Cal Newport. Cal, welcome to Money Talks.
Emily, thanks for having me.
He's a contributing writer at The New Yorker, where he writes a column called Office Space. Cal's latest book is called Slow Productivity, The Lost Art of Accomplishment Without Burnout. I mean, how would you describe it to people who have not read it?
Well, it's an answer to a question that became more important for a lot of people, I think, during the pandemic, especially people who worked office jobs. Is there a way to think about productivity that could both support good work that also doesn't completely exhaust you, that doesn't impede on all other aspects of your life? Can we, in other words, reform the very notion of productivity itself to be something sustainable for these type of jobs?
Yeah, it somehow inspired me to both work less and more. Can't wait to get into it. So if you have a job or you do any kind of work, I feel like you should be reading Cal's column. It's basically an indispensable go-to source for anyone who cares about what happens at work, which, especially over the past few years, as we've, you know, gone through the work from home revolution, then the great resignation and quiet quitting, and now AI, it's like you turn to Cal to like understand what's happening and to feel sometimes outraged, if you ask me. So I guess let's just start off by talking about the book.
Yeah.
I mean, why do you think you needed to write it? Or maybe put another way, like, why were people so burnt out? Why did that happen at such an extraordinary level then?
Well, here's my theory that I lay out, which is we go all the way back to the rise of knowledge work. We can use that term. The rise of knowledge work as a major economic sector. This is really the mid 20th century. And there's this real quandary that faced those who were really pushing and helping us understand this new type of work. And that was, we had no easy way to measure productivity. So knowledge work becomes this big thing in the 1950s, grows from there. Of course, the economic engine of the world at that point was industrial manufacturing. And this was a sector in which we had very clear definitions of productivity because we could measure things. How many Model Ts were produced per labor hour input? And we had clearly defined production systems. And if you change something, you could see if that number got better. Hey, the assembly line made that number 10 times better. So let's switch to the assembly line. It was this very quantitative, concrete way of thinking about productivity. Then knowledge work comes along and that all falls apart. Because in knowledge work, you're often working on many different things. And what you're doing might be different than what the person right next to you is working on. It's not clear who's working on what. And it's not clear how people are organizing their work. How you do this is a personal decision in knowledge work. We invented a term that to a previous age would be oxymoronic, which is personal productivity. Productivity was at the core of how you ran a factory. The idea that this would be personal was a real change. So everything was obfuscated. So we couldn't measure things anymore, right? There's no number to measure. So what did we do? Well, the mid-century solution was pseudo-productivity.
Mm-hmm.
We will just look at visible effort as a kind of crude proxy for that you're doing something useful. And this was okay until we got to the late 90s, early 2000s, and we got computers and we got networks and laptops and smartphones. I often see things through the lens of technology because I'm a computer scientist. I think pseudo-productivity plus email, plus work that could follow you home, plus a never-ending stream of work you could always be working on. That was a volatile combination. This proverbial beaker sort of overflowed, and this is when we began to get much more acute burnout. So it was technology crashing with this crude approximation of productivity that had been around for a few decades. It just didn't play nice in a world of Slack, email, and iPhones.
So I love this. I mean, so it's basically like pseudo-productivity is FaceTime. It's like back in before everyone was working from home, you know, you came in early, ideally before 9, right? So the boss could see you coming in early. It's your car in the lot before everyone else. You put in your hours in the office and then you were present. You were pseudo-productive. It's not clear what you were even doing at the desk. And then you left. And then technology happens and it's like you don't just have to be at the desk anymore. Then after hours, you have to respond to an email so people know you're productive, et cetera, et cetera. Then it just keeps getting worse and worse. And now you have your phone. So you have to check the email all the time and the phone all the time. Then the pandemic hits and you can't do that FaceTime piece anymore in the office. So you're trying to do the pseudo productivity from home. And then you're really screwed for burnout because you're basically like trying to prove you're always thinking about work, always on. Or if you're dealing with a child at home, you know, don't worry, you can reach me at 11 p.m. after the kids are sleeping. And it just, it people start to spiral.
Yeah. And there was this terrible spiral that happened during the early pandemic where two other things went into that picture. One, the number of meetings grew just because there's a lot of informal coordination you do in the office where I could just grab you in the hallway and be like, hey, what about this? When we're all at home, we can't do that. So we're like, oh, let's set up a Zoom meeting to talk about this. But wait, our calendar works in increments of 30 minutes. So now every hallway conversation got its own 30-minute meeting on our calendar. God. And we began to get that phenomenon. I call it the Zoom apocalypse in my book, where, and it's not an exaggeration, people would say to me, I have 8 hours of Zoom. My number one issue is, where do I go to the bathroom? Like, it's just Zoom, 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 Zoom all day long. And the pandemic, because it shifted things remote, generated about 25% more tasks than we had basically overnight, like 25% more tasks to deal with going remote. It just spiraled completely out of control. I think this is what led a lot of people to say, enough. We got things like the Great Resignation. We got quiet quitting. We got the hybrid work wars. We went over the cliff of absurdity with this long tail of pseudo productivity clashing with technology. The pandemic pushed us over the edge. And when you're doing 8 hours of meeting a day, talking about work, having to wait till 11 at night to actually do the work, it's hard not to look at your professional life and say, okay, clearly something's broken here.
Yeah. So, I mean, your book is actually, it's really simple the way it's written. I love it. It's like you have these three principles, very much like Michael Pollan's famous, you know, eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
Yep.
Yours is three principles, and definitely correct me if I got this wrong, but I think the three principles are do fewer things, work at a natural pace, obsess over quality. I'd love to like just go through each one. You don't have to front run the whole book, but maybe just give people a taste.
Yeah, the quick summary of each is do fewer things. This scares people the most, I think.
Yeah.
Because this is the one they think is going to get them in trouble. But I think I've learned it helps when I reword that slightly to do fewer things at once. So actually,
okay.
Doing fewer different things at once, like the number of things that are on your plate at any moment is much less. You're actually probably going to be finishing many more things than you are right now, right? And there's a whole argument about when something is on your plate, it brings with it administrative overhead. Whether you want it to or not, it's going to take up X hours of your time per week once you commit to it. So if you have too many things on your plate, more and more of your time gets taken up by this overhead tax, leaving less room for you to actually get the work done, and the work gets done at a lower quality. So if you do less things at a time, less of your time is spent actually servicing stuff on your plate. More of your time goes to execution and you actually do better work. And you're probably going to have a higher rate of completing things anyways. The second principle, work at a natural pace. The idea of sitting for 8 hours and working at full intensity is not natural. Our brains aren't wired to do it. We did it for factories. We invented this idea for factories, and it was so terrible that we had to invent labor unions and huge regulatory apparatuses just to like keep people willing to do these jobs. And yet in knowledge work, we just said, well, let's just copy that.
You call it, we work in invisible factories, right?
It's an invisible factory. Yeah. But without the labor unions or regulatory protections, like let's just like work all day long. That's an incredibly unnatural thing to do. It's like saying to humans, I think we're going to work mainly underwater. You know, it's like we're meant to breathe air, right? That's not the natural way that we actually operate. So we need to have more variability and intensity at different time scales. And then the final principle is the glue for all of this. It's not just what do I want to reduce? I want to do less work. I want to have less hard moments of intensity. The third principle brings in the opposite, which is, okay, but counterpoint this with obsessing over the quality of what you do. And for a lot of reasons, that obsession over quality becomes both the glue and the engine that can make those first two principles something that really works well, makes that a sustainable plan.
So, okay, let's just take a break here. And when we come back, I want to kind of break down these three things and talk about some of the strategies you offer to actually put these principles into practice. And maybe we can talk about some of the famous thinkers and writers and inventors that you use in the book as examples for each of these things. So do fewer things. I have a lot of thoughts here. First of all, it's like, well, yeah, if I want to avoid burnout, I should do less things. Like, thanks, Cal. Like, great idea. Can you tell my boss? How do you put that into practice as someone who is, you know, for the person who's actually employed as a full-time, you know, worker? How do you set those boundaries?
Well, I think there's two big ideas here. I mean, one is introduced before. Doing fewer things at once is not about reducing the total number of things you finish, right? These are two different things. So presumably, and this is a big jump because, you know, this is not the way all bosses operate, but presumably if we're being super rational, a move to do fewer things at once means you're going to be finishing more things that are valuable. And actually from a boss's perspective, they should be great. Like in a perfect world, if they are keeping track of, all right, Emily, what did you produce this year that was valuable for us? That will be larger if you're doing fewer things at once. Of course, that's not always the reality of how this works, because in the moment, a boss might be in a pseudo-productivity mindset of, no, if you're saying no to this now, that is you reducing visible activity. So I'm going to assume that you're doing less useful effort, right? So pseudo-productivity warps what would actually be the rational thing to do here, which is doing a very small number of things at once means you're going to actually be way more valuable for us. So how do we deal with a pseudo-productivity culture where we're trying to do this slower alternative? A lot of my advice for how to pull this off centers around trying to make transparent your workloads. Like a big issue with overload is that we obfuscate workloads. I can push things towards you with a low friction email. I can just grab you at the end of the Zoom and say, hey, can you do this or do that? I have no idea how much else you're working on. In fact, I just imagine that you're doing nothing else. I'm just imagining I gave you this thing. It's going to be useful if you do it for me. Why can't you just do this for me, right? When we make our workloads more transparent, it introduces interesting dynamics into the system. And like this is as much a thought experiment here as a piece of advice, but just to do the thought experiment.
Yeah.
Imagine you just have a shared document, right? And at the top, it's, here are the things I'm actively working on right now. Big divider line. All right, now here's the queue of things I've agreed to do that are going to come next in the order that I'm going to tackle them. And when someone's like, hey, Emily, can you throw together X or Y? You say, yeah, great. Just go throw it on to my work document. And they have to now come in and confront, oh, this is 10 things down on this list. They're confronting the reality of your workload. At the very worst, this will at least reset their expectations of, okay, this is not something Emily is actively working on. In fact, it's going to be a while till she's actively working on this. Look at this big queue here. And at best, it leads them to say, oh, wow, you're swamped. Okay, no. Keep doing what you're doing. I didn't realize the full magnitude of the different things people had put on your plate. That's a bit of a thought experiment, but not really that far from some of the advice I give, is there's a lot of ways that you can basically deal with the reality of how much is on your plate and how much time it's going to require. And when new work comes at you, you confront it in that reality, whether it's actually showing someone that list or just you trying to find the time on your calendar when you're going to execute things and just being honest about when that is. It makes a big difference when people have to confront that you're not just a task executor that's making their life easier in the moment, but someone who actually has a full existence in this workplace with many different things you're working on, and they can sense what that magnitude really is.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. I was thinking the next time someone says, can you do X story? Can you file this? Can you do that? I would say like, okay, if I do that, that means I'm also working on this other story and that'll push it back a couple of days. Is that okay? I also had like this interview scheduled today that I won't be able to do. Like, is that, what do you think about that? Just being more open about like what I have going on and how this new assignment or new idea is going to like throw all that other stuff off is like one way of dealing with it, basically.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, you can imagine even having a list week by week. Here's what I'm working on each week. And when someone brings you something, you can actually show it to them or put it in an email like, okay, like, do you want me to put it 4 weeks from now? Or do you want me to bump one of these things earlier? I can do either. You know, you let me know. That really makes a big difference when people actually have to confront, like, okay, you know, how much work are you actually doing?
It's interesting too, because sometimes you can get more quality work done, and you really get into this when you're just have less to do. Like as a journalist, I find there's on days where I don't have a deadline, I actually have some time and I don't have anything to do is my most productive day. Cause that's when I come up with the best ideas, or, you know, I decide to call someone for no reason and stuff like that. That seems harder to justify than saying like, oh, I have all this stuff to do and I'm adding your thing means X, Y, Z. It's harder to be like, oh, I was really hoping that on Thursday I wouldn't really do much so I could come up with something amazing. You know, it seems like that's a tougher kind of sell.
Well, can I give you a big idea and a small idea? This got me thinking about. All right. So the big idea, this is a way I think you might be able to implement the thing you're saying there is even hard. All right. Imagine if we said, let's rethink hybrid work. So we know hybrid schedules has become essentially the new norm among what are known as remote capable jobs, which is like most of knowledge work jobs. And there's good data on this from Gallup. Hybrid is basically by far the majority now setup of these jobs, hybrid work. Yeah. All right. What if we said, in addition to saying, here's days each week you're at home, and here's the days that you're in the office. By the way, the days you're at home, no meetings, no email, no calls.
That could work.
That happens on the days you're in the office. The days you're at home, you're executing, getting things done. I think that would actually work. In fact, I think we've already done the harder thing there, which is regularly having days when you're not in the office. Like the pandemic did the hard work of breaking that seal. That was something that for over a decade, we tried to make happen. And people were saying, this just, I don't know about this. I don't like this. We all have to be in the office. That was the hard work. So that's my big idea. The small idea I will throw out, another even simpler way to do this is quotas. So for certain types of work, you just have a count. Like I do this much of these things each quarter. You know, like I'm a professor, I need to do peer review. I can't just do peer review all day. So I decide 5 papers a semester, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. This is really simple. It also works well because when someone says, hey, can you jump on and do this thing for me? You can say, yeah, I do a lot of those, love doing that. But you know what? I maintain a quota of doing 10 of those per quarter, and I've already hit that quota. So I don't really, I'd have to wait till the next quarter to do it. That's effective too, because people, the pushback, they have to basically say, your quota's wrong.
Right.
You should do more of this. And usually it's like a pretty limited thing. When you confront people with the reality of workloads in your time, if you do so in a conscientious manner, not in a reactive manner, not in an accusatory manner, but just like, I'm on the ball. I keep very careful track of things. I don't have time for this now. Here's why. It blows people back away. They're like, oh, okay. Yeah, good. That makes sense. Great. You're on the ball. In fact, this really sounds unusual to people, but it's true. It can actually make people respect you more. Like, oh, wow. Like Emily's really organized.
Very organized.
This was great. I had this interaction. She keeps track of like when everything's going to get done. This is great compared to like her colleague over here who, you have to just email like all day long to finally get them to do something. You can have that counter signaling effect of I'm saying no. And yet we come away from this conversation with you more impressed by me than you were. So it completely dismantles the pseudo productivity dynamics.
Yeah, I love it. Another more bigger picture thing I was thinking reading your book. I mean, your book is really for individuals, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, individuals like me, like hacks like that can really help us organize or strategies. But like some of the best changes to the way people work over time have really come from collective action. I mean, you mentioned like labor regulations, and I write a lot about these, the 40-hour work week, unions, protections against child labor, all that stuff. It comes from people like kind of like banding together to make change. And it was striking me like these hacks are great, but wouldn't it be nice if like a leader came in or and changed the rules a bit and said, we're not going to do dumb meetings anymore, or no one has to take meetings Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or something like that. Or on the flip side, if like workers all somehow miraculously came together and like rejiggered the way we work to make more sense. I mean, what are your thoughts on like how much individuals can really do to implement a lot of this stuff versus collective action or leadership changes?
Well, I think systemic changes are ultimately what's going to make the biggest difference for knowledge work, by which I mean, like you're talking about, here is how our organization runs. Like from the top down and bottom up, we all agree it's no more pseudo productivity. It's no more hyperactive hive mind, back and forth, haphazard email communication. It turns out this is way harder than I had hoped. I wrote a book before this one called A World Without Email that was aimed really at people who run organizations. And I said, let me tell you the whole history of how we got to a workflow in which we check an inbox once every 5 minutes. Let me explain to you the TikTok science, like step-by-step science of why this is terribly unproductive. It's a terrible way to run your organization. I know it's convenient that everyone can just reach everyone at every time, but it's like turning the lights off at the Ford factory to save money on your electric bill. No one can get the steering wheels put in the right place. It's absurd. And let me talk about how you could rebuild new collaboration systems. Like this is not stuff individuals can do, but like how you could do this as a company. And everyone's going to be happier. You're going to be much more productive. Very little change came from that. And so I'm like, well, okay, what's going on? Like, we're running these companies. It's not smart the way we're running them. Why can't we change this? And it's a little bit of a different situation than the classic collective action labor bargaining situation, because in those situations, there was a clear zero-sum dynamic. Mm-hmm. It is better for the owners of capital for you to work more hours in the factory for less money. It is better for you, the worker, to work less hours for more money at zero sum. So you need collective action to actually have like a fair back and forth negotiation. In knowledge work, it's even more complicated and simpler in the sense that the way we're working is bad for everybody. It's not as we often think. It's not the same zero sum dynamics as a factory, right? It doesn't make the CEO of your company richer if you're answering emails once every 5 minutes, or if you're completely overloaded and exhausted. It makes the company worse, right? So we're all on the same side here. So if it's not a zero-sum game, like if we're going to follow game theory metaphors here, we could think of it more accurately as an inefficient Nash equilibrium. We're sort of stuck in this way of working that's very difficult to reconfigure, right? It's no one person can drastically change the way collaboration happens. And so I looked into this, like why aren't there more companies that say, we're completely getting rid of email, we're doing things in a completely different way, it's going to be hard, but we're going to be happier and more productive. Why won't the market forces just reward that company and then it'll spread really quick?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is, I found an interesting answer in the work of Alfred Chandler, the economic historian Alfred Chandler, who had this really important book that won all the awards in the 70s called The Visible Hand. And he really gets into the concept of managerial capitalism. And he says, in managerial capitalism, where you have this disintermediation between the owner of a business and the managers, you have a big manager class. Uh-huh. The managerial behavior is not driven by market forces. And in fact, it's driven by other types of forces like stability and convenience and making their own, you know, positions better. In other words, you can have a large company running in a way that makes them less efficient, and yet not have market pressure to fix that, because in managerial capitalism, other things can overtake that. And that seems to be what has happened in a lot of these issues with knowledge worker overload. It's just too hard to try to fix this. It's better if you're someone who could fix this to just keep the status quo, because it's stable, it's not as scary for you, it's not going to require as much effort, and it seems to be fine.
I mean, it's sort of like explains why remote work finally and hybrid work is catching on. Like you said earlier, it's like there was a big exogenous or external shock, the pandemic, and it actually forced the change.
Yeah.
And like, unless that something like that happens, it's hard. Managers aren't going to move because it's just too risky and they're comfortable working the way they're working.
I wrote this piece on remote work for The New Yorker right at the beginning of the pandemic. And it was fascinating what I uncovered, right? This is right as this was happening. Mm-hmm. And basically the story is around 2006, we had all the technology in place to do remote work. So we had broadband internet access was common. We had voice over IP. And then Skype in 2006 introduced video conferencing over IP. So low-cost video conferencing. Email was already at this point, and laptops were already common. And there was these tentative experimentations with remote work in that period, like 2007 to 2011. And the managers involved were like, no. This is no good. And they had all these complaints. They're very worried about it. And it just died. Like, all of the workers wanted this. There was really good survey data. Like, they want flexibility, right? And it was completely technically possible. And the manager, like, this will never work. And then the pandemic comes along and like, oh, I guess it does work. literally overnight, they're like, oh, I guess we could have done this. But because you're right. Like, even though it could have helped you recruit, it could have made your company more agile. It would have given you access to talent pools beyond your local geographic area that surrounds where your office happens to be located. It would have been better from a market perspective for a lot of these companies to go remote earlier, but they didn't, because it would also be hard and it would threaten them. And they class stability is more important, and first mover principles are scary. And so they just stayed doing it the way they were doing it. That's where we are now, I think, with this work overload, the haphazardness, the ad hoc nature, the pseudo productivity grip. That's where we are now. And it's why in this book, I'm like, okay, well, let's start with what you can do to at least like start to move away from this as an individual.
Wait, so you wrote a whole book about how email is bad and like we should move away from it. I feel like since then, I mean, a little bit workplaces have moved away from email, but not in favor of anything that makes my life easier. It's like there's now Slack and there's like the Trello board and there are all these other like tools and Microsoft Teams and just multiplication of places where people can now reach you and contact you. I mean, Do you have a stance on Slack, Cal, or any of those kind of real-time chat tools?
Oh, do I? Yeah, so Slack I put in the same category as email, right? Mm-hmm. So the actual thing here I care about is a mode of collaboration that I call the hyperactive hive mind, which is just we figure things out on the fly, unscheduled back and forth messaging. This is what email very quickly evolved to, even though it was introduced to replace voicemail. It very quickly evolved into this sort of pseudo real-time back and forth collaboration tool. Mm-hmm. Hey, what about this client meeting tomorrow? And we start sending messages back and forth. Slack just came along and said, okay, if that's the way you're going to work, if you're going to use the hyperactive hive mind, from just a straight interface perspective, email is kind of a clunky tool. This is like a streamlined tool for doing that. Like,
yeah.
We want chat. We don't want to use CC. So it was, I wrote this article when Salesforce bought Slack where the title was Slack built the right tool for the wrong way to work. And that's how I understand it. It was like, if we're going to do the hyperactive hive mind, why are we using a mail metaphor? We should use a chat metaphor. Then we have the world of productivity tools like Trello, et cetera. I think those could play a role in a much better way of working. But the problem is we have it backwards in knowledge work right now, where we think the tool itself is what's going to change the way we work. And I think that's the tail wagging the dog. What I argue in that email book is no, you need to figure out first the system, the process. Here's how we're going to collaborate, right? You have to come up with collaboration processes that doesn't require all these ad hoc messages going back and forth, and then say, what tool can we use to implement this? And then there's plenty of them. The thing is, like sometimes like Trello would be interesting. A lot of these processes, a shared document, like that's enough, right? Like it doesn't take high-tech tools to do it, but Silicon Valley sees this as a multi-trillion dollar opportunity. They know how inefficient knowledge workers are. They know checking an inbox once every 5 minutes is a terrible way to extract value from the human brains. But they want it to be the secret sauce of the interface of my complicated tool is what's going to save you. So you should pay $20 a month per seat to do this. And we're going along with it. I think we like this idea of if I pay for a monday.com subscription, I'll solve these problems. But you can't solve it with the tool. You got to solve it with the process. And that requires everyone to be involved.
Speaking of solving with the tool and Silicon Valley forcing us in using technology we don't really need, I'm worried about AI's role in the workplace now. I mean, I'm reading, you know, a lot of techno-optimists saying like it's going to hypercharge productivity and AI is going to really empower us to do better. And I know that there are managers and leaders now who are saying like you have to start using it, but not really saying how or why even. Are you following that?
Oh, yeah. So I'm following it closely, you know, so last year I wrote a big piece for The New Yorker that just tried to get down into the technical details of how does a large language model work. I have another piece that's either out right now or coming out soon. We're working on it. That's looking at the next generation of these tools. So I'm watching it with interest. I've also done a lot of briefings on this. I've been, you know, doing briefings up on the Hill with senators and briefings at various boards of directors. So I'm really plugged in and interested in this. And you know, one of the things I would say right now about this new era of generative AI is that the iteration of this tool that was released in late 2022, so ChatGPT, I talk into a chat window and it talks back. That iteration was not ready to radically reconfigure work. And it didn't, right? We actually did not see, the first year that was around, we did not see a lot of cases where that radically reconfigured work. The optimist had the sort of pick and choose, look at this company over here that laid off these people. But for the most part, it actually had very little impact. That form factor is not the right form factor to disrupt work, right? So when mm-hmm. we see technology massively disrupt work, typically when it's poised to disrupt, it goes fast, right? So this is what happened with email. Man, you put, you know, email in an office and within days, that office is functioning universally and completely differently.
Right.
We're not seeing that with AI in its current form. And what's happening now in AI is they're trying to figure out how to make it more useful to work. So there's a lot of building tools around the underlying language model so that it can talk to your email, so that it can talk to PowerPoint. We'll see what happens with that. That might gain traction. But I think the real big future of AI and work is not going to be just a newer version of GPT. So the type of AI that runs things like ChatGPT or Claude or these other competitors, that has a really big weakness, which is it can't simulate the future. So these language models, and I won't get technical about it, but they're static feed-forward models. They're incredibly powerful and they're huge, but they can't look into the future. Mm-hmm. And almost everything we do that's not directly related to just producing text or summarizing text, which these models do very well, we're simulating the future. We're simulating, well, if I said this, how would it make that person feel? And then what would, okay, so then I should probably say that. Or in figuring out what task to do next during your day, you're doing these internal simulations of, if I get this done, that would lead to this, but then this won't get done. There's other types of AI that can do that, largely in the world of game bots. And the interesting effort right now, as far as I'm concerned, is the effort to bring these worlds together. So if you want an AI one day that's going to clean your inbox for you, it's not going to be GPT-7. It's going to be some mix of a large language model plus a completely other type of model, maybe adapted from, you know, playing board games, probably mixed in with a completely other type of model. That's when things are going to get interesting. So that's where I stand on it now, is that I think language models by themselves might not be the massive disruptor that people are thinking. They're going to be a very useful tool. But language models plus other AIs, that's when things are going to start to get interesting.
I'm curious how good you are at following your own rules. Can you talk a little bit about your own personal productivity hacks and routines?
Well, you know, when I write these books, it's usually 50% this is interesting to people and 50% I desperately need this, right? So slow productivity is no exception to that. I would say one of the personal inspirations for writing the book was actually just my three boys were getting to a certain age. They got all elementary school age at the same time now, where suddenly they needed as many minutes of dad's time as possible. And so for me, I said, oh my God, the thing I'm interested in now is how can I still do work that I'm proud of and supports my family, but also have a whole lot of time for this? Oh God, I have to completely rethink productivity. A few things I do that I think are aligned with the philosophy of slow productivity is I fix my schedule. These are the hours I work. I don't work outside those hours. So if I want to do more things, something has to give or I have to get more efficient about something. So I just don't put on the table to the extent possible time outside of a normal workday, right? I do this even more narrowly for things within my workday. So when I added a podcast to my plate, which I was very nervous about from a time consumption perspective, early in the pandemic, I said, okay, you get a half day a week. That's it. You got to fit in that half day a week. And whatever I can do in that half day a week, great. But if I want to do more and more things with the show, then I'm going to have to, you know, grow it big enough that it can generate enough money to hire someone to take on things because I can't change the time. That's the footprint you get, you know, and maybe that makes it grow slower, but it keeps the time constraint. So I think I'm reducing the total number of things on my plate. I'm trying to do fewer things. The third principle is obsess over quality. You know, this is me really engaging with my New Yorker position. It's really hard to write for them and you really have to keep pushing yourself. But I know the better I do at what I do, the more opportunities and inspiration for slowness I'll have. So I'm putting these ideas into practice the best I can because I desperately need them.
That's great. I mean, so much of this advice seems like it's going to work better for people. I was thinking about women, especially with young kids, like you have very little control over your time then. Like they can, you know, you can get a phone call from the school or from daycare, or whatever, and like that's your day. It's over. You know what I mean? You have to pick someone up who's sick or just your time is not the same as it used to be. Do you think this advice is doable for people in that kind of situation or people who can't turn down work because they need the money, that kind of stuff? Is this more of like a privileged sphere?
Well, no, I would say for parents in particular, that's secretly the target audience, right? Mm-hmm. It's actually the young people, you know, without kids and flexible time that look at something like slow productivity and say, well, who cares? Like, what else do I have to do? Mm-hmm. I can play the pseudo productivity game because I'm 24 and why not, right? So I'll just get after it and send emails all night and like jump on calls and volunteer to do all the trips. It's the parents among us or the people taking care of the ailing relative, those that just don't have unlimited time and the time we have is highly unpredictable. This is what we need if we want to sustainably thrive in something like the knowledge sector is less things on our plate, but the things we do are at a much higher level of quality and a built-in variable rhythm of intensity. That's a definition of productivity that has the flexibility to give in a schedule, to bend and flex around the complexities of life. And so it's the parents, I think, among the audience that are like, okay, yes, we need to figure out how to do something like this. It's the people without the extra responsibilities to say, well, why not just, it's easy. Just go on all the trips and do all the emails. Why not? Like, that's easier to do. And remember, keep in mind, the advantage of slow productivity, it's not just your life gets better. You do what you're doing better as well, right? I mean, and ultimately the vision with slow productivity is that you take more and more control and autonomy over your work life as you get better at the core things you do. And as you gain more control, you keep leveraging that to keep the workloads reasonable, to keep the pace. You know what to do with that autonomy. You don't just reinvest the autonomy you gain by getting better into more money or the next higher level of prestige. You realize, what if I invested this into more flexibility in my schedule? What if I invested this into being able to keep the number of things I do smaller? So it's basically a recipe for survival if you're in some sort of competitive knowledge work area, but you're not able or willing to inflexibly give every minute you have to your work.
That's great. Cal, thank you so much for coming on. And what's the name of your podcast so people can listen?
Oh, it's called Deep Questions.
Great. And you can find it anywhere you listen to podcasts?
Anywhere you listen to podcasts. Yep.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thanks, Emily. I enjoyed it.
That's it for our show this week. Thank you, Jared Downing and Shayna Roth, for producing. I'll be back in your feed on Saturday along with Felix and Elizabeth for a regular episode of Slate Money. Until then, thanks for listening.